Okay, that's I guess all the redistribution we can count on. I've been asked to chair this session today, during which we hope to really take a look into the use and appropriateness of the evolutionary metaphors in two areas. One is in the area of technological innovation, and the other is in the area of cultural change. And I think it's very important in the state of the subject as it is at the moment that we accept the basic, I hope you'll accept the basic assumption that there is no such thing as a stupid question. If you haven't got that mindset, try to get it while the talks are going on, because at the moment, we're all of us groping to try to find out whether or where or how these models which are drawn from biology might help us understand the subjects that we're in. To begin with, we have two speakers who've worked extensively in the field of technological innovation. James Fleck is at the University of Edinburgh Business School and applies his mind to information and information technology and how those things affect the innovation process. And he's going to try to bring to you some of his latest thinking on this matter. James, would you like to make a start? You have 30 minutes starting now.
Thank you, Mike. Well, I hope in increasing the population density, we don't increase the intellectual density, perhaps, of the audience. It is a fascinating question, one that's caused a lot of interest, a lot of metaphorical use of evolution, because quite evidently, whenever you take a look at some area of technology all the time, it clearly evolves in some very loose general sense. I've been working for some longer than I like to think, in fact, 15 to 20 years, on technology development. That's the subject that fascinates me, and in that time I've seen many other empirical studies being carried out as well. And I have a sense that underlying many of these empirical studies, there is a deep structure, and that deep structure connects up with evolutionary models. It's very provisional. There are many different models. No one quite agrees how to apply the evolutionary metaphor or theory. And that's what I hope I can do in some way, cast some light on this afternoon. In the course of these 15 years of looking at technology development, I also migrated through a variety of disciplines: sociology of science, philosophy of science, history of technology, economics of innovation, management of innovation, more recently operations management, management of technology. And through all of those disciplines, again, this sense of a deep structure of common to all types of technology development. And that was reinforced also by looking at a variety of different technologies, from artificial intelligence and expert systems, to industrial robots and factory automation, to company-wide information systems and financial services, and more recently, to looking at the process of development of multimedia. All these disparate areas with this underlying deep structure. Above all, I was particularly struck when reading other people's work, that as you struggle away in your little neck of the woods, trying to make sense of this wealth of empirical information, hey presto, you read a book by someone else, and they've already said it all, far more elegantly than you can, but it's the same common structure. That gives me confidence that there is a material to grasp here, and again, it's this material that hauntingly, frustratingly often, hints at evolutionary models. And what I want to do is to sketch in this afternoon some of that material for you. So I want to look at some approaches in technology development. That will really be the meat of what I want to talk about. After that, I want to try and pull some threads together and ask this very important question, which is really the question mark in the title. What is the right focus for applying evolutionary models, evolutionary theory, to the development of technology? Is it the artifact? If it is the artifact, in what way do we grasp at the artifact to develop a theoretical model? That, I hope, then give me the basis to comment on the role of the artifact and how we might look at evolutionary models. And then beyond that, I want to, by way of why that, make some remarks on the question of scale, how large, what is the basic entity, what level of analysis is most appropriate for getting some value added out of applying evolutionary theories. And finally, I want to touch on this suggestion that perhaps we're moving into an era where technology, in some sense, is becoming more evolutionary. Okay, well, there are many approaches to technology development. I'll touch briefly on these ones to give you a hint of some sense that, of the work that's going on. I won't be able to unpack them in detail, but maybe I can sketch in enough material to give us substance for some form of discussion about how evolutionary models might apply. First of all, we've got this old favourite, the linear model. Very much a straw man in studies, detailed studies of innovation. Basic idea is that a technology is invented somewhere, then that technology is languishing in the basement or whatever, until it's put to use as in a company using it as a process, or sold on the market, i.e. until it's innovated, it will have no effect whatsoever on the world. Once it's out in the world, there then follows this phase in which that initial technology is imitated and developed by others. And some models take into account the fact that the market is there, consumers are providing indications of their preferences, and that acts in a very simple, straightforward way as a selection mechanism of a variation generated by inventive genius. So we have here, in this very simple model, which still, I think, drives much of policy thinking and often is a starting point for people looking at technology afresh or from outside, we have a very simple model for application of evolutionary models. However, if we look in more detail at some of the work that's carried out, and the most concerted effort on technology development as an evolutionary process that I've come across, I think, is Basala, and my background paper for this really focused on that. Basala has quite a clear focus on the artifact as the unit that evolutionary theory should tackle. He states, he argues that the artifact is the fundamental unit for the study of technology, and that continuity prevails throughout the made world. The existence of continuity implies that not all artifacts can only arise from artifactual antecedents, that new kinds of made things are never pure creations of theory, ingenuity, or fancy. And he also stresses that later on. So he sees the continuity, the transmission of the evolutionary material, if you like, as being based in the artifact. However, he emphasizes the role of practical knowledge, that artifacts can't be described, technology can't be described purely in words and theories. He says, because all of technology can never be translated into words, pictures, or mathematical equations, the practitioner with a hands-on knowledge will always have a role to play in the dissemination of technical inventions. And in fact, he elaborates that in a number of case studies. So even though he's got a focus on the artifacts, he's recognizing that you need to look at these people with hands-on, practical knowledge and skill. So the people are involved in it at the level of generating the variety, creating the ideas. And here he's saying, again, that technological activity produces made things unlike other areas of cultural activity. It's the made things, the artifacts are the distinguishing feature. Coming on to selection, he argues that selection is carried out through human intervention. Human beings are the intermediaries who make choices. It's a rather voluntaristic approach, but it's a firm commitment, it's a clear theory. It's his preferred approach. All the factors, social, psychological, economic, cultural, are reflected in individuals who then act as a selection agent. He also follows up with commenting that in line with the evolutionary theory, he sees there is no place for a long-run technological progress, no absolute measure of technological progress. So that's one approach pitched clearly at the level of the artifact. Another seminal work, and this is based on, I think, 562 innovations drawn from a survey by another couple of authors. Atabak and Abernathy, I noticed that the rate of innovation, the rate of change, is systematically related between products, the physical artifacts that are sold to consumers, and the processes through which they are made. That's quite an elaborate theory. It's acted as a heuristic for much of management thinking, particularly pertains to the car industry, but it's also been applied elsewhere. The important point here is that as well as innovations at the level of the artifact product, there's also a systematic pattern of innovations in the processes producing the product. And that's really the point that I want to stress from that particular approach. Nelson and Winter produced a seminal work on evolutionary economics, which has led to a vast array of more specific economic work, attacking of orthodox profit maximization and equilibrium views of economics. They have a clear focus on the firm, not the technology, but the firm. And organizational routines, the ways that firms habitually carry out their tasks, produce their products, go about their business, he sees as the, or they see as the equivalent of genes. And we have, going ahead on the selection front, activities of search, which seek to modify and alter those genes. They basically see firms as exhibiting continuity in behavior through their organizational routines. The search mechanisms, research and development, other arrangements within the organization seek to basically look for mutations that may be beneficial. And finally, the selection environment, which includes market as well as regulatory aspects, will weed out and select those successful routines. But more specifically on technology, their work has, I think, caused particular further interest in development of places like Manchester. The idea of natural trajectories in which a body of knowledge, a way of carrying out and developing technology, is explored and has continuity over time. Natural trajectories are such things as pursuit of economies of scale, the long run mechanization of manual work in many industries. They're across many firms. They're, in a sense, very common natural trajectories, but there are also patterns of development that are more specific to particular firms. So this is another slant, quite distinct from Salas in its focusing on the organizational routines. The knowledge behind the organization is explicitly mentioned. Underlying technological regimes, there is a body of knowledge held by the technicians, etc. So they look at the production process as well as the products, and they are emphasizing the role and importance of knowledge as part of the genetic material through which the evolutionary process can work. More detailed micro work on innovation. One of the very interesting areas, particularly for my work, has been Eric von Hippel's focusing in on sources of innovation. And what he observed was that innovation doesn't always come from the manufacturers of the product, of an artifact, but that in many cases, such as scientific instruments, which is the example depicted here, the users will put together the new artifact in a breadboarded fashion. Other users will imitate them. And then only after that knowledge about the artifact is widespread does it become formalized into a commercial product. So we have a detailed wrinkle on the production process for the artifact that captures captures the role of various agents in creating variety. That's the broadening out from what we might see as initial creators of technology, all to look at areas, and it's common in mechanical engineering as well, outside the what is the parent source of the technology. Now my own work, which started out wrestling with the example of industrial robots, I've focused on the idea that it's there in the literature of configurations variously grabbed at. What interested me here is that when you look at the pattern of development, technology development in robots, it doesn't come from one center and then spread out in unchanged form. What's going on is a variety of components are being built up into very specific systems that immediately build into those systems the requirements of the environment in which they're working. So right straight away, the exigencies of application are built into the system. In fact, at Edinburgh, the term social shaping has emerged, and this is one form of social shaping in which, in some large companies, you can see that the company structure becomes a template for large software systems that then become packaged as a technology that's sold on separate. So you can see that the exigencies of use are built into the technology at the development, the implementation of the software. This can be a recursive sort of position. We have here overtones of Schumpeterian recombinations. What's nice about this is that you get continuity in the components, but by jiggling the components about, it's the innovation at the level of the configuration is what often has an impact. And if you think of the current example, call-centered industry, the direct line motor insurance phenomena, for instance, that is all the components, computers, telephones, are proven standard components, but the way in which they're put together in that industry is a new development, and it's radically restructured industry to such an extent 80% of all motor insurance is now sold through direct line. As well as technical hardware components, in that example you can clearly see software components and indeed non-technical components. If you phone up and ask for a quote of one of these systems, there'll be a charming voice at the other end that's very efficient, talks to you, and painlessly gets you to agree to sign up and buy your insurance with them. That interchange, the protocols for that interchange, are currently the subject of a lot of research. They clearly make the overall configuration work, but they're not specifically technical. What's going on here, looking at it as a technology development process, is that a generic model or configuration is in fact being adapted to all its particular applications by means of incorporating local process knowledge. Knowledge about motor insurance is built into the databases. Knowledge about consumer behavior is built into the protocols for talking to the customers. And it's that ongoing process of innovation each time this model is applied that gives it a particular evolutionary flavor. And in fact, we see that the innovation phase and the diffusion phase, in fact, are collapsed together it's something that I called in fusion. That model applies quite nicely to robotics and other large complex technologies. The most extreme examples we see now with network technologies, where by definition many agents across a network are participating in the innovation. The most extreme case perhaps is with multimedia, where the unity of the hardware and software with the content is what gives a distinctive new multimedia product. There's no center of emergence. It's a very much an evolutionary and a loose term, but also I think in quite a specific term, pattern over time. Now by way of perhaps light relief, I thought it'd be nice to look at some pictures of real technology rather than just talking about it. So let me very briefly just draw some. These are robotics. And here we have a very large muscular robot. And its entire configuration is dictated by the application, in this case spot welding. It can move linearly. It has to be very rigid because spot welding demands high position accuracy, and it has to be able to carry the weight of the spot welding equipment. So you have, on the one hand, the generic technology, the robot itself. On the other hand, you have the configuration is very much reflecting the application. And that makes each robotic configuration very different. Here you have quite a different cylindrical robot serving a manufacturing cell with a range of other machines, a part of the system, components of the system. In this case, you need very sophisticated gripper technology to enable that to work. So we call it industrial robots, but it's quite a different configuration. Yet another example, assembly robots. This time we have two robotic arms, because assembly is very difficult to do with one hand, you can try it out yourself. Usually requires 2 points of contact, and working within constrained spaces is a Cartesian constraints in this case, with various feeders for the other parts. Again, the overall configuration is built in situ, reflecting the exigencies of use. And finally, this is one of my favorite ones, the sheep shearing robot. Very much experimental, of course, and Australian, as you might expect. Again, the overall configuration reflects the peculiarities and exigencies of use. If you put a sheep on its side, apparently it will lie there quite happily on its shore. But just in case it doesn't, they've got a nose clamp and various other pieces. Very important to this configuration are sophisticated mathematical models that map where the surface of the sheep is, so that the cutter is actually cut just wool and not ears and legs. However, I often observe to people that Australia also exports mutton, doesn't it? This reminds me of one of the best stories. You know, in doing empirical research, you always come up with tales and anecdotes. And it's all about the Japanese gentleman talking to an American who told him that they had designed a shaving robot. And the American was horrified. I mean, he said, but how on earth do you get the robot to cater for all the different shapes and dimensions of faces without cutting people? And the Japanese gentleman said, ah, no problem. After one shave, all faces the same. So, looking at this, I have prepared a very complex diagram. I won't try to explain it here. After Eric von Hippel tried to get the details of the process in. What I would draw your attention to is this bottom line here, which suggests over time, both long time and in particular innovation time in a particular firm, you find that suppliers, manufacturers give way to the users. So we've got a process of innovation where the users are driving the development because of this importance of the configurational level. So that's my range of approaches. What can we say about these? As I think you can see, we've got different implicit models of evolution. Which on earth is the best one? How do we make sense of them? How do we couple them together? And this boils down to, I think, to what role of the artifact, coming back to the question mark of my title. The first point is that artifacts are only one facet of technology development. That's, I think, very important. Even Vassala observed that you need practical knowledge to produce these artifacts. The other research, in which I've played part, and many other colleagues, have also emphasized you can't just look at the artifact by itself. You have to look at the processes which produce the artifact as well. Atabak and Abernethy looked at the relationships there. Nelson and Winter explicitly focused on the organizational routines and technological regimes that produce the artifacts. And in the configurational analysis, there's also an articulated process that produces the artifact. And this, in turn, suggests that the organizational context, the way in which all these things are put together, if you like, the institutional context, is crucial. You can't just look at artifacts by themselves. You have to look at the specific arrangements for producing artifacts and bringing all these other things together. And this is quite nicely captured, I think, by when I'm discussing technology, I point out to my students that it's no use, and these are people involved in managing technology firms, it's no use just focusing on the technology. You really have to look at everything around that technology. It goes far beyond just the organizational context. Different technologies are triggering some of these aspects more than others. In some cases, for instance, industry structure, the availability of maintenance of the technology, especially high technology, is absolutely crucial. The technology will not work, it will not survive in evolutionary terms if you don't have that component, that essential underpinning. A far nicer model has been produced by Arnold Pacey, and it's saying the same sort of thing, and many researchers are also saying the same sort of thing. They are looking at technology not as just artifacts, but embedded in the system of production and processes around. And Pacey's model separates out cultural aspects that are drawn from the wider society, organizational aspects, and way down here, in what he calls the restricted meaning of technology, you've got the artifact. And he applies this to explaining why it is that, say, for instance, water pumps set into a variety of third world villages work in some cases, don't work in others. It's not the artifact per se, it's the whole system around the artifact that is also important. So that's I think that the evolutionary model has to focus on the artifact embedded in this overall system. The other, another point is that a range of different forms of knowledge is important. Not just theoretical knowledge. Vassala emphasized practical knowledge. Nelson and Winter have emphasized tacit knowledge, and other people have emphasized other types of knowledge. It's this range of knowledge that's brought together different disciplines, different sources, different forms of knowledge, that creates or gives a basis for a variety generating process in the evolutionary model. Again, these sorts of observations are made throughout much of the practical and the theoretical work on innovation around. One Nixon essay looking at the role of knowledge in engineering is by Walter Vincenzi, looking at aeronautical engineering, and he's identified not only a number of different types of knowledge, but also a number of different types of knowledge-generating activities. And what he's saying is that all of those are necessary, not just formal theoretical knowledge, but all of these different types of knowledge are necessary in order to produce aerobics. And I think that to focus on that sort of structure will be very important for any competent theory, evolutionary theory. But finally, artifacts are the discriminating feature of technology as a particular cultural form. there is a danger, I fundamentally disagree with in much of the literature, to forget about art. And scholarly academics get together and they never bother about the nitty-gritty bit of metal there. Oh, no, that doesn't matter. What's important is knowledge. But if you do that, you actually lose the focus that makes sense of these other things. So in a very important sense, I think the focus on the artifact is essential. The artifacts evolve, yes, but unlike human organisms, which contain the genetic code within themselves, technology evolves but contains its genetic code, its blueprints, in these institutionally based knowledge structures which produce them. And that, I think, is the best focus to go in to look at evolutionary models and technology development. By way of starting to wind up now, is this issue of scale. At what level do we apply these models? Well, as we saw from the linear model, at sufficiently small scales, when you zoomed out and you're looking at everything, all the variety generating, the creative process, gets shrunk to a point. And basically, a crude form of selectionism by markets or whatever over time is fine, but it doesn't tell you anything. It's just a truism, just describes, doesn't really explain very much. The other extreme, once you zero right in, once you talk to individuals involved directly in the technology development process, everything is seen as problem solving, the sort of rational design predominates. More and more people are becoming aware that's not sufficient, and there are models trying to elaborate out from individual creativity to incorporate something of the selection environment, that by and large, you've got two extremes. For my money, again, it's at intermediate scales where we've got the material for a really interesting and worthwhile theory of technological innovation, where you have structured genetic production processes, and we've seen a range of different detailed processes which produce technology, from von Hippel, Nelson Winter configuration analysis. They interact with selection mechanisms. That's the fertile ground, I think, for the evolution. And finally, that concomitant to that is that organizations are the key evolving entities which exude artifacts. That's a conclusion that I draw from this. What I would say is that organizations are not necessarily firms. And especially today, we are seeing networked technologies where the organization is distributed over there. And increasingly, it's very difficult to draw a boundary to the firm. So organization, institution, in some sense, is the entity. It's very difficult to pin that down because they themselves are evolving out of being neat and tidy, well-bounded organisms. So to conclude now, I suggested at the outset that I think in important senses, technology is becoming evolutionary. This is marked by a number of features. Product life cycles are becoming very short, so in a sense, we see sequences of products rather than one product dominated or being around for a long time. Increasing users are becoming involved in IT and they change in different directions. Quality function deployment, there are now explicit design methods to try to build the ultimate use context into the design process. We see parts of the selection environment being built into sophisticated creation environments. Many large companies have always recognized the importance through portfolio of R&D, through explicit trial and error of the evolutionary nature of technology. People talk about the learning organization, which is able to bring in on board again some of these evolutionary processes. So I think all over we're seeing technology changing shape, organizations changing shape, as selection becomes built into the technology development process itself.
Peter. Thank you very much, James. For those of you who may be coming this afternoon to this topic for the first time, let me tell you that James has let you off easy, because the battle lines within the field are partly drawn by those who would say that you have to move to the level of knowledge to understand disciplinary change, and the fact that he's plumped for the level of the artifact is to put one's feet down in a certain camp. Just so you won't think I'm kidding you, the next speaker coming along is in the technology as a form of knowledge school, and hopefully that will fuel our debate. The next speaker, I should tell you, is an extraordinary individual. If ever you have an opportunity to hear this man discourse on the pharmaceutical industry, do not miss it. It is always nice to be in the presence of someone who's actually mastered all the data. And Richard Stankiewicz from the University of Lund is one such person. However, he wouldn't come here on a summer's day. It'd be sort of labor his knowledge at you. He's going to talk about something a bit different. Clearly, to understand the pharmaceutical industry, he's had to labor with the nature of R&D processes. And in trying to understand that, he's been pushed in the direction of evolutionary theory. And as I said earlier, the role of knowledge as an explanatory factor in evolutionary change. Ricard, will you come and give your talk now?
Well, thank you, Mike. You have introduced my talk extremely well. I indeed do represent somewhat different perspective on evolution modeling of technology, one which stresses learning processes and the growth of technological knowledge. And there are various reasons why this perspective, which is obviously complementary to the artifact perspective, I mean, I do not see a conflict there, though we always tend to emphasize our own particular view somewhat at the expense of that. They're obviously complementary, but there are certain specific reasons why I believe that the knowledge perspective is of great interest. What does it mean that we try to develop an evolutionary theory of technology? Well, in very broad terms, it means that we believe that technological change exhibits certain patterns that are similar to other known evolutionary systems, mainly biological systems. From that, we conclude that there exist certain basic mechanisms behind our technological change, which must be at least analogous to those which drive biological evolution. And most people who subscribe to evolutionary theory of technology will say that, yes, there is something which we might call the evolutionary algorithm. And it's got those generic components of creating diversity, selection, and selective retention. This is stated in many different ways by different authors, but this is the basic kind of thing. And we believe that, then you could say that the evolutionary research program is to show that this indeed is the case, that the patterns of technical change that we can observe can be derived from the operation of this sort of evolutionary algorithm. Well, in order to prove that, we need to say something about the mechanisms through which or in which the evolutionary algorithm is actually implemented. And I would say that most of evolutionary theorizing about technology really sidesteps this issue. We have quite a lot interesting analysis of the patterns of technological change. We have now a very rich and I think extremely useful vocabulary to describe those patterns. We have technological paradigms and trajectories, we have the lock-in phenomenon, all those kind of things that in various ways reassemble a biological evolution. But when we look at the actual models of how this comes about in detail, we look for something that would correspond in culture and technological evolution to what genetics is in biology. Well, we don't find it. And so there is a need to focus on those processes which we can assume are somehow embodiment of the mechanism, the basic mechanism which implement the evolutionary algorithm. And it is in this context that the study of R&D processes becomes important, because obviously if technology is evolutionary, then R&D processes, which are nowadays the main type of process which generates new technology, should also be interpreted as evolutionary. They are actually the mechanism through which evolution proceeds. Though I wouldn't say that they are, that only formal R&D has that function. That it is just a part of a larger learning process. But it is interesting to study because it's well structured, accessible, transparent, and can be analyzed more easily. So this explains my interest in looking at R&D processes in this evolutionary perspective. Now, why is it that we don't have a well-articulated evolutionary theory of technological learning today? It's odd because, in a sense, when you look at all kinds of theories, speculations, hypotheses about the nature of invention and creativity, which have been around for at least 100 years, and you see that there are several evolutionary or quasi-evolutionary themes present. One was already mentioned by Jimmy. The idea that technology grows out of technology, that there is a gradual progression from one artifact to another, tells you quite a lot about the nature of the process by which technology is generated. It's obviously very evolutionary in its intent. Another evolutionary hypothesis, which has been very influential, is that technology is usually a product of recombination. New technologies usually from recombination of existing technologies. That obviously relates very closely to the first one, to the continuity. And now I'd like to say a few words about this combinatorial or recombination hypothesis, because it's very central in evolutionary modeling. The history is, as I said, quite old. It starts with Poincaré and Adamar's analysis of the creativity process in mathematics, where they maintain that creativity is a product of recombination of ideas, of fusion of ideas. It's been picked up later by various social scientists like Ogburn, the American sociologist of technology, who built actually quite a sophisticated theory which tried to explain most of the technological change in terms of recombination. His idea is that new technology is a result of recombining already existing elements. And as new elements are added, the set from which new combinations can be formed increases. That means that there is some kind of exponential growth of technology. There's an acceleration of technological creativity based on these recombinations which add up to a larger and larger pool of elements. The basic same idea has been taken up by the economist Schumpeter, who talked about new combinations as the driving force in economic innovation. And more recently, we had Arthur Kessler's ideas about the combinatorial nature of creativity. It has been used by people in technological forecasting, developing so-called morphological methods. And recently, it has been stressed very strongly by, for instance, Paul David in his work on the importance of the stock of knowledge as the pool from which The materials are drawn for new innovations, and it has been taken up in certain forms of artificial intelligence within main genetic algorithms. Another theme that has been reappearing all the time is that of randomness, or at least of independence of the variety generating mechanism, the selection mechanism. And it has appeared in a number of different shapes. For instance, the role of error in both scientific and technical creativity has been emphasized by many writers. Serendipity is another manifestation of the role of chance in technology. And for a long time, I think, most people would think that the appearance of the role of chance was a curiosity. Serendipity would be an unusual event. It was very interesting because contradictory to the rationalistic notion of technology development. But in fact, now many of us would claim that the chance events of this sort are in fact one of basic constitutive elements of the creative process. They are not odd happenings, but in fact they are extremely fundamentally important. So why haven't all those elements come together into a coherent theory of creativity in technology, some sort of model of invention? Well, I think there are many different reasons. One is that evolutionary theorizing always creates a certain amount of opposition. It's not the terrible popular theory. Now, many people feel very badly about it. It's felt to be somewhat demeaning. It is easier to accept it in biology, though even there was very considerable opposition to it, and still is. But it's very, very hard, really, to accept within social and cultural sciences. It contradicts the notion of rationality as we conventionally understand it. It contradicts the insight that human behavior is intentional. It collides with the fact that we seldom perceive our behavior as random. If you claim that randomness is an important element in technological creativity, industrial scientists explode. They say this is absolute untrue. We are trying to be as rational as possible. We try to minimize those kind of things. And if we are at random, we are deliberately, then we randomize our experiments. But it's a different kind of thing from being non-intentionally random. But there are also other reasons for resistance. Obviously, the social Darwinism has done a lot of damage to the evolutionary project in social sciences. So many of you who at heart were evolutionists wouldn't simply admit to it. Some of the people I've mentioned here definitely act that way. And also, we have at least since the Second World War, I've been very strongly influenced by what James called the linear model of innovation, which is sort of presenting a picture of technology becoming progressively scientified. So all those elements which are traditionally associated with evolutionary process, random generation of variations, selection in this what I call natural environment and so forth, were felt to decline in importance. The opposite of what James was saying, that you believe that there is an increase in the relevance of evolutionary thinking with the growth of technology, where linear people would say that it decreases, that eventually we will get rid of this evolutionary mess and we'll have purely rational problem-solving technology. Well, despite all those difficulties, we finally started getting beginnings of an evolutionary model of technological change and R&D process. And it started in the 60s and 70s. It had roots early, partly dependent on the fact that the linear model has collapsed, that we now have much more sophisticated view of what type of learning processes are important in technology, what kind of types of knowledge are important, But there were other more specific developments which helped along. Now, one was the emergence of the evolution economics school within economics. And it is, if I have 2 minutes, a school which started under very specific circumstances and which has a certain very special attitude, if you will, to our evolutionary process. Actually, the school can be traced back to the 50s to a very particular environment in the United States, Grand Corporation, the Air Force think tank, who engaged in the analysis aiming to advise the Air Force in designing the R&D programs. And Rand Corporation had a highly rationalistic view of how you plan research. One used a lot of very sophisticated mathematical systems analysis to devise various policies. And this sort of approach was creating difficulties for some of the economists in Rand Corporation, who found it increasingly difficult to believe that real policies in technology are actually made that way. And people like Alcon, Arrow, Burton Klein, and several others sort of revolted against this idea and started emphasizing that every form of production of knowledge or innovative behavior cannot be planned rationally. It has to be organized in terms of multiple parallel approaches. And having done that, they really started developing evolutionary theory of economics, which was put in place by Nelson and Winter, who are also Rand people. This particular way of looking at technological evolution, but really it is a theory of economic evolution rather than technological, strictly speaking, has been shaped by two things. First of all, the main problem that economists address is the problem of the allocation of resources. And the kind of theory which grew at Rand Corporation emphasized that aspect. Decision-making processes, the way that resources are allocated, where the central problem with this evolutionary theory was to solve. In terms of pinning down the mechanism of evolutionary change, I think one could say that Nelson and Winter were very strongly influenced by Simon sort of type of artificial intelligence research, with which you might be familiar. I'm not going to go into it, but it paints a certain picture of how problems are solved, emphasizing the use of heuristic rules. This type of theory was sufficient for Nelson and Winter to build a larger economic theory, which was mainly concerned with broader developmental patterns, not with the R&D process itself. And the connection between this theory and the early version of artificial intelligence, as represented by Herbert Simon, I think has been causing some problems for those of us who would like to use this theory to actually describe what happens in the laboratories. It's partly not sufficiently worked out in detail. It's very schematic. But that's not the fundamental flaw. You can always add the details. But it has this hierarchical structure, which I think conflicts quite a bit with what we actually see when we look at what happens in the labs. But there was, at the same time, or somewhat later, another tradition growing up, which I think has not yet made much impact on evolutionary theories of technology, but which I firmly believe will make considerable impact. And that was the tradition which goes under the name of evolutionary epistemology, and which developed mainly in context of understanding science rather than technology. It has really not been applied to technology to any significant extent yet, though it obviously could be so applied, and I think it would be very fruitful if one does. I do not have time to go into details about what evolution epistemology is, but an important feature of the theory is that it can eliminate some of the difficulties in using evolutionary thinking in relation to technology that I've mentioned earlier. For instance, the question of intentionality, the question of quasi-Lamarckian nature of technological evolution, and so forth. We might have time later on to go into some questions concerning this particular approach. But I'd like to finish by saying that much would be gained if those two traditions, one deriving from evolution economics and based on Simon-type artificial intelligence, were brought closer together with evolution epistemology models. And there are certain developments in both in cognitive science generally and specifically in genetic algorithms and such fields, which I think create certain formal tools using which we could do it. However, in order to do so, we would have to devote greater effort to doing actual deep empirical studies of the R&D processes as they actually happen. And surprisingly, there has been extremely few such studies up to date. I am not saying that there haven't been studies of the innovation processes, focusing on specific innovations. There have been very few studies of the R&D processes from the evolutionary perspective. And I looked at it carefully because, as Mike said, I'm interested in pharmaceutical R&D, and this is a wonderful type of R&D to apply the evolutionary ideas. It's very easy to apply evolutionary ideas. So I thought there would be plenty of papers, theoretical models, but not. So I perhaps could end here by suggesting that this is the way we should go.
Okay, John, half an hour for questions, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. There's one slight variation between the program and the data. So we're going to have, if you can pace yourself now, right? You're running out of caffeine. How long is it going to last? 30 more minutes, okay? And then I'll stop and we'll go and have a cup of tea that way. Now, I would like to generate some activity. And I don't want to put too much strain on you, but could you exercise, if you can, the discipline of either asking a question, or if you can't really bring yourself to do that, try to end your comment with a question, so that these guys have got some chance of answering it all. What I propose to do is to let the questions flow for about 20 minutes, and then give the two speakers the last word to try to pick up what they can understand of your comments and questions to answer. Can you cope with that? You cope with that, all right? Okay, who'd like to start off? And can you speak up, first of all? We haven't got a microphone, and I know it's boring, but can you say who you are and where you come from, please?
Thank you. I'm Andy Wells. I'm in the psychology department at LSE. I have two questions, and they are both questions.
Good.
The first is a general one, and I think could be asked of either of our speakers, and it's this. isn't there a paradox in bringing evolutionary thinking to technology, given that evolution shows us essentially how complex systems can be produced in the absence of design, whereas technology seems explicitly to have to do with the development of complex systems, artifacts, specifically as a result of the application of design. So I wonder whether there just isn't a mismatch. More specifically, a question for James. You mentioned that you thought that the appropriate scale at which we should think of applying evolutionary ideas is at an intermediate scale. And if I understood you right, you were suggesting that we could think of organizational routines as being analogous to genotypes, and of artifacts as being analogous to their phenotypic expressions. Now, if I've understood that rightly, and if that is what you intended, then isn't there a gap? Because ordinarily speaking, the phenotypic expressions are responsible by surviving and or reproducing for the genotypes which are present in the next generation. Whereas it seems to me that there's no essential connection between your notion of an organizational routine which could continue to exist whether or not its phenotypic expressions are successful.
Thank you very much. Next question? That takes some digesting, doesn't it?
Jim Davis, retired industrial scientist. Presumably in any one industry, say the pharmaceutical industry, your mature corporation, I'm not talking about the same, you want an earlier company, but mature corporation, the structures, the R&D structures are presumably very similar. And this would go back because the managers in the different companies all trained at the same business school, trained at the same universities. So in these big mature companies, I suspect these structures are not similar.
Good, thank you very much. Third question? Do you want to have a go at the first one? Well, they're gestating. And then will you pick up the second part of his question?
Sure.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, this is a very relevant point. There is a certain amount of, there is a paradox here, right? Because I think it was in one of Dawkins' books, he has a chapter where he compares the development of radar, which is a technology, with development of bats, sonar system. And the point is that he's trying to show that nature, biological evolution, can achieve as much as design. There is also this philosophical point, the argument from design, which is sort of a thing that the fundamentalists would use to hit evolutionists on the head. So there is the perception that design and evolution are mutually exclusive things. But I don't think they are. One way of coping with this terminological problem is that which Dennett adopted in his latest book, in actually his last two books about evolutionary theory, where he talks about design spaces, right? And design itself is an evolutionary process in the sense that we move through a space of technical possibilities, often by marginally varying pre-existing designs and configurations. And see, when you look at in detail at what happens when technologies are designed, this is what you are seeing. It is very, very rare that something springs completely de novo. Right? So despite of the fact that we have a conscious design process, it does exhibit several properties of an evolutionary development. What makes the design process conscious and intentional is that we have such internalized the selection environment. So the engineer who is designing is carrying out continuously sort of mental experimentation. Nowadays, that can be reinforced by using all kinds of computing devices, for instance. Simulation, the rational drug design, for instance, builds on our ability to amplify our mental powers by visualizing chemical structures. Earlier, we had to use a pen and pencil or build mental models. I think that the problem arises from the fact that we use the term design in two senses. Design can be taken to be a blueprint. And it's very true that every time you have a large artificial system, it usually has been built to some kind of a blueprint. Right? You could say that biological evolution also produces blueprints. DNA is a blueprint for an organism. But when Dawkins writes his chapter about bats and radar, he doesn't really talk about blueprint. He talks about design as a process. And I believe that his argument falls because both are evolutionary. So he really hasn't found yet the counterexample.
Phenotypes and genotypes.
Well, if I can start off with commenting on the design paradox too, it's really part of the same thing, I think. Design is a process. It's not something that individuals do entirely by themselves. The space shuttle is achieved not by an individual designing it, but by a complex institutional structure that extends through industry structures, incorporates vast bodies of knowledge, and no one individual can possibly design even a small part of that. So there is a sense in which design is distributed through organizational routines. The fact that bits can be designed rationally is simply part of the mechanism for the overall process, which I think can be subject to evolutionary analysis. And that also relates to the second point. I don't think you can. I wouldn't like to restrict the Nelson Winter's idea of organizational routines is a rich and useful one, but I wouldn't like to restrict it just to organizational routines. I think that the technology complex that may incorporate the implicit division of labor over an industry is also important. So it's, and it will depend on the technology, which the particular artifact, which set of factors are crucial in the providing evolutionary material. But I would challenge the suggestion anyway that an organizational routine related to development of technology could possibly continue to exist without successful phenotypic expression. The bridge that falls down is not a good bridge, and those routines that led to that rapidly get weeded out. That uncertainty about innovation, which runs right through all of the literature, is also part, even though you have rational design, you still have this essential uncertainty, which verifies the knowledge through, exactly through. That, I think, is the power or the interest in looking at technological evolution via artifacts, rather than just generally at knowledge evolution. The phenotypic expression artifacts is essential for the continuity of those other structures.
Sikor?
I would like to ask this, Jack Cohen, a biologist and other Warwick University. I want to ask you about blueprints. I think blueprint is a very misleading concept, which is why I want you both to tell me what you think a blueprint is, but if I could preface it, I went to Dennett's lecture the day before yesterday at the Geographical Society, and he had a beautiful example, which those of you who work there, I'd like to share with you. He said, for a start, that blueprints are not blueprints in the sense that they are not contextual. You need a context for a blueprint to work in. A blueprint doesn't tell you how to do the thing. In a given context, it does. And he said, as so many of us have said, it's like a recipe. But he said, it's like a recipe, not that says 2 pounds of flour and 2 pounds. It's like a recipe that says, in this kitchen, reach down there and get 2 handfuls of whatever's down there. Then reach your hand up and get whatever's there and pour it in. And then do this, and then put the thing on your oven to horizontal. It doesn't say, do things to get give an effect. It says, do this, and that's all. Now, within that system, you don't have any mapping between what you might call a root blueprint and your artifact or your organism. You have to bring in the whole context. And in that system, the parallel I came to hear about today was, I want you to tell me how blueprints could give me wire recorders, tape recorders, CDs, and discs in the same way as I have bats flying and birds flying, and there seem to be gelled regions of Dennett space in which things happen. Flight is one, the recording of sound is another. It's done by such radically different mechanisms. And that, it seems to me, is what we have to explain. And if you can do it with blueprints, I'm interested to hear how.
Paul David.
Paul David, economic history, from Oxford. Three elementary questions, please. First, would the speakers define what they mean when they refer to evolutionary processes? Is it at least distinguished by continuity, by incrementalism, by non-reversibility, by something closer to Darwinian evolution or not? Second, would they then say, what did they mean when they referred to technology and technologies? Are technologies individual artifacts? Are they complexes of artifacts? Are they systems of organization and production? And finally, would they identify at what levels of technology they think that evolutionary processes operate, at both meta levels, at individual levels, and indicate why? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just to give the microprocessors a chance to work, has anybody got a simple question we can interpose now before they have to answer? Anybody threatening to ask something? No help, eh? No help from the audience. Which of you wants to have a bash?
First of all, the blueprint question, the easy one. I don't think blueprints by themselves are sufficient at all. I don't think anyone would ever think that. The whole point of organizational routines, the whole point of the technology complex, is that blueprints are part of that overall production process. And the point of not just looking at artifacts, but looking at the technology complex, is precisely so that the whole thing that's relevant for that particular artifact is brought into play. Now, in practice, I believe you can't do that readily easily. The organization boundaries are there, that the differences between one technology and another are in fact marked by boundaries of organization and expertise. And when you take a particular technology, you can then follow through all the various aspects of the technology complex or PACES structure, whatever structure for understanding technology in context you need, and then you can look at the role that blueprints play in that. In some industries, that's highly, the blueprints, if you like, are highly automated and defined. In other industries, they're very much tacitly embodied in the people who are producing the artifact. So you need the whole production process, which is organizationally contextualized, to produce the artifact. Hence, the need to look at the artifact in conjunction with everything else. If I can go on to Paul's questions, evolutionary processes. I don't think we should get too caught up on a specific definition of evolution. I think that, especially in looking at technological evolution, many of the discussions do suggest continuity and incremental changes. Others focus on the possibility of recombinations for producing revolutionary breaks. I think we need to look at the whole lot and not just simply be tied down to a mechanistic application of the current biological view of what evolution is. It's it's clearly interesting also to understand why technologies evolve gradually in that even very minimal, not a Darwinian evolution sense at all, as well as looking at Darwinian selection processes operating on particular combinations that are offered up to it. What is technology? Technology is one of those general portmanteau words, I think Jerome called them. It covers so many things that it's not really competent to ask for a definition of technology. All you can do is to ask for a pointer to technology. And for my, what I'm suggesting, we need the artifact as that pointer. You start at the artifact, that is the an artifact that, if you like, has the phenotypic power of expression in the world, is a good definition of technology. And that, I think, is a good heuristic starting point. Beyond that, you want to look at particular case studies and look at the technology in those cases. And I wouldn't suggest we get one mechanism that covers the whole lot. I think we're going to have a range of mechanisms, as David Hull showed very clearly in his book on biological evolution. In his discussion there, he showed that the evolutionary process works at many levels across many different entities, populations, genes, right down to the genes. So we shouldn't perhaps get too caught up on trying to define too precisely. There's a rich material there. Let's start out from particular examples and work out what the evolutionary processes are in each of them. And I think that really covers the issue of levels as well. I'm particularly interested in the configurational technologies, which are assemblies of, in a limit, completely standard components that have, nevertheless, they make sense as a combined thing in their own right, and they have dramatic changes, like call center technology, like the direct line model. That is a configuration, and in that case, the evolutionary pressure is acting at the configurational level rather than at the immediate component level. So though I wouldn't deny that within, say, Nelson and Winter trajectory, an airframe, development of an airframe, there are probably also selection processes through success charts, failures over time of particular components that are shaping, say, the comfort factor in passenger seats. You just have to read your magazines to discover they are trying to do various things to make them more comfortable. So I think that technology has to be looked at as a very rich field, and you need to shift down to particularity. I think you can get too lost at the very general level.
Do you
want to
add a gloss there?
Well, yes. I agree with Jimmy that perhaps we shouldn't get too involved in the matters of definition, what is the essence of evolution and things like that. However, the question becomes important once we try to specify our theory. So, are you a neo-Darwinian or not? Right? I mean, if you are, then there are certain things that follow. And if you are not, then you have much greater degrees of freedom to model things in different ways. For my own part, I think that things such as the importance of independence, of variation and selection, okay, is extremely important. I think that if you remove that, not much is left of evolution model. And that's why I think, for instance, that the role of randomness in evolutionary processes is quite considerable, and I believe it does operate also in our creative processes to a large extent. I think also that if you are trying to construct an evolutionary model, you have to pay attention to what I would call the population dimension. Evolutionary processes are, so to speak, massively parallel processes. So they have to be taking place within a very large number of units. One of the problems that cultural evolution people face is that many of the things that are described as evolutionary occur in so few units that it's very difficult to see how the ordinary evolutionary process could produce results. So there must be something else hidden away that we don't see, in which those processes operate. Then about the technology and levels of, now I think those are interconnected issues. For instance, the economics, evolution economics stresses the firm as the main unit of analysis. Firms are interactors, and various technogenes survive or fail to survive with the fortunes of the firms which carry them. I belong to the other school, which is much more individualistic in approach. I believe that the individuals and technological communities are at least as important units in the analysis of how technology grows. I tend to be somewhat skeptical about using a firm as sort of equivalent of phenotype or interactor. Nelson and Winter's routines usually refer to very complex patterns of behavior. We know that very complex patterns of behavior rarely correspond to a single gene, to a single man, or whatever it is. They are products of interactions with a large number of men and a given environment in which they express themselves. And I think that I personally have a tendency to look at firms as sort of ecological systems within which evolutionary processes take place, rather than elementary units of.
Question at the back there.
Yeah, this question's for both speakers.
Who are you? Who are you?
Sorry, David Porphyry in the philosophy department. You've both reviewed and to a certain extent called for empirical studies of technological evolution. And you've also reviewed some theoretical models, many of which were first formulated more or less explicitly mathematical. Do you think that the subject needs, at the moment, more or less mathematization?
You want to go first?
Well, I think both yes and no. I think we should proceed in both directions. I mean, quite obviously, as I mentioned, there are several developments, mainly in artificial intelligence, which allow us to construct formal models. And why not? But I think that we do need input from empirical studies to inform those models. So I think right now, if there is some clear deficiency, it's on the empirical side rather than on the side of modeling. But perhaps the modeling people would have a different
view.
I wish I could find the apt
mathematical expression for capturing technological evolution. I think that's the problem. There are many enticing models, but when one gets into mathematization, one also often gets focused on the models rather than the reality to which the models are trying to be applied. Empirical studies, I think all of those frameworks I commented on, von Hippel, Nelson Winter, Abernathy, Nottepark, are based on very detailed or large sets of empirical investigation, but not the right sort. I think what we need are further empirical studies that take seriously the issue, the evolutionary issues, picking out whichever particular form of evolutionary framework you want to apply. If it's Darwinian, then you have to cast it in terms and identify the basic elements that are at work. And before we can get on to heavyweight mathematization, we really need to get the conceptual partitioning clear, so that we know how to measure the things that we're then going to model.
Good. Yes?
Robin, I'm an energy grad working in social work now, but what interests me about this, is there anything you can say about the actual cultural, it's a fascinating question, the cultural conditions which lead to an explosion of technology in some countries, obviously the Industrial Revolution around about 1870 in England, and other countries you have a stagnant society. And then what makes it take off permanently? I mean, I think in the early Middle Ages, I was recently reading an essay about that. It happened in Charlemagne's time, the technological revolution of the early Middle Ages, but that didn't lead to the Industrial Revolution. We had to wait for 700 years. And isn't the cultural factor as important as any more kind of schematic, biological view of the revolution in regards to technology? Both of you, I like that.
Yeah, well, we'll do that. Have a shot?
Well, in my studies of the history of the pharmaceutical industry, you see clearly how the rate of technological change changes and how the investment in R&D increases over time. Until the turn of the end of the 18th century, we had no industrial research oriented with development of new drugs. There was some research concerned with testing, standardization, quality control of old products. Interestingly, this is the type of research that usually is first in place when industrial research develops. You do not start with developing products, you start with testing products you already have. You have to internalize selection environment. R&D, industrial R&D, is mainly about internalizing selection environment. So instead of putting your products out on the market directly and make huge losses, you can pre-test them and you minimize the failure rate. When can you do that? It obviously depends on the accumulation of knowledge. You do have to know something about the selection environment. You also have to have technology in order to produce variation in controlled manner. In pharmaceuticals, it was closely associated with the development of organic synthesis. It created a new search space. It extended enormously the search space that the developments of drugs could use looking for new drugs. Next big expansion came with biotechnology, where now we can use very large molecules as well as the small ones. But at the same time, on the other side, you had this accumulation of testing techniques. Pharmacology made it possible for companies to set up their research operations. Since then, we have put layer upon layer upon layer of new testing and evaluation methodologies. And that makes R&D productive. That means that we spend more on it and the rate of progress increases. And this is basically the same part in another industry.
Okay, thank you. Now, I have no further questions, and we're getting near to tea time. So I was going to ask James to deal with that bit of the question that he feels he wants to, and then begin your sum up, would you? And when he's
finished, technology development and culture. Culture is an explicitly important part in technology development. Pacey's model looks at it, general ideas of progress are important. I don't know that we are sure that we have discovered the conditions for continuing technology development. That is something that we have to wait to see. There's a fascinating study that I read, and I cannot remember the author, who looked at technological development among the Polynesian, I think it was, and suggested that that came to an end. Once they achieved their version of paradise, they lost their technical skills because they were living and enjoying the fruits of their knowledge. That may be the case. It's a sort of a technological version of Fukuyama's end of history, perhaps. Basala was he came down at the end of the day in favor of the cultural factors as being over-determining for technology development. Today, if we look at the example of the car industry, the so-called lean production paradigm, the modern way of making automobiles that uses far less capital investment, a different way of employing labor that originated in Japan, was taken to the States via the transplants, and then eventually, rather reluctantly, firms like General Motors took it up. Their cultural resonances there are very interesting, and not quite what one expects. They're not generalized belief in progress. They're more to do with how organizations are structured and whether they will accept a measure of responsibility for the workforce or not, rather than deep-seated attitudes that stop workers from adopting new technology. As shown in particular by the fact that the successful General Motors joint venture, NUMMI, used United Auto Worker Union members to drive this new form. It's just that what suggested it wasn't the cultural aspects to do with attitudes, but more to do with how work could be divided among different people. I wanted to wind up just on a personal note by suggesting that I think there is a research program that I think would be fruitful. That's as much a statement of belief as you can get, I think. And that would be to look at the equivalent of the human genome, but of technology. And I think that that could be of vital importance for our future well-being. What we need to do is to start at the artifact and look at what the key determining genotypes, if you like, what are the, how are the blueprints, the production process translated? Can we apply insights from biological evolutionary theory to give us a better understanding of that? That would be one line I'd be interested in following up.
Now, there's one unanswered question which Ricard is going to absorb into his thoughts.
It's about the question the gentleman here raised about are companies just becoming alike, the diversity being lost because of training and other processes. I think it's a serious problem in large companies. Indeed, there are many question marks about the creativity of such companies. However, large companies can be creative provided that they put in place certain type of policies. And I have my pet theory, which is sort of a grand theory because it explains many historical events. Why we had two explosions of creativity during the course of Western civilization, with the classical Greece and then scientific revolution period. Now, there have been certain structural, cultural features of societies at that time. The Greek society was divided into small states, which were fiercely independent, which couldn't dominate each other, which each evolved their religions, cultures, science, philosophy, what have you, and yet communicated intensely. So those beliefs, those attitudes, those ideas were constantly mutually challenged. They shared language and proximity at the same time as there were all those different cultural niches allowing diversity. The same happens in Europe. We had the collapse of the dominance of the Catholic Church, the Europe disintegrates into nation states, yet it is a cultural unit in a sense. There's a very dense communication, but a number of highly different environments allowing a variety to develop. That creates an explosion in creativity.
Thank you very much. I have to tell you now that to invite you to take tea in the top floor of the student cafe, which is through that sign there, not surprisingly called T. That's the good news. The bad news is that I don't get my fee unless I get you back here by 5 o'clock. So you can expect me to start haranguing you. No sooner do you have the cup in your hands. May I ask you to thank the speakers in the usual way, please? Thank you very much.
They had, what's the word, evolved over the centuries. Now, the point I want to make is a very simple one. I'm making it with these three little pictures here, and that is to say, we have here very similar displays of objects, material objects. They are, of course, there are diagrams of them, but they are essentially material objects. From different times and different spheres of life, and yet they all have similar properties of variation, change, etc. I mean, won't go into all of that. You can see the general similarity between them. Now, ever since Darwin, bless his cotton socks, as you might say, we know how to interpret this sort of phenomenon. And John has spent his life telling us exactly in very minute detail some peculiar little quirks that actually are done within the framework, within the paradigm of the Darwinian system. Darwinian processes, variation, selection, natural selection, adaptation, etc. The theme that of this forum, in many ways, can be summed up in how can we exploit the evident analogies between these different diagrams here and the possible structural phenomena behind them. That's what I want to talk about very briefly. It has to be extremely schematic. This is an enormous subject. Well, first of all, insofar as there are, we're assuming that there are some parallels and analogies between organic and technological evolution, let us ask what structural analogies there are. In what sense can you say that these things might be based upon a similar sort of processes? And I give you there a very brief list of some of the things that are going on technological innovation, expressing them in the language, in the actually more familiar language, as it happens now after a century or so of Darwinism, and in the more familiar language of biological evolution. That is to say, I'm saying, okay, we think we know a great deal about biological evolution. What are the analogous phenomena, structural phenomena, in technological systems? And I'm not going to go through all of these, because some of them have already been discussed by Jamie and Rickard this afternoon, and it would take too long to go on at length about it. But I think it's fair to say that if you go into what actually happens in technological evolution, the evolution of human artifacts, you can find processes going on that are analogous to the processes there which I talked about, which I note down in the case of biology. All right? There's no point in going through all of that because it's the bread and butter, so to speak, of this whole subject. Okay. Do it. Now, the interesting question is, does that mean that these are equivalent in some, shall we say, phenomenological way? We know we can identify various processes that go on. Does that mean that the overall processes of the system behaves in the same sort of way? In other words, can we identify phenomena in the history of technology which are comparable to those in the historical record, the historical biological record? And I give you now a list. Can you believe it? This is a serious list drawn from books such as Basala's, Melchior's book, and so on, of the various phenomena which have been identified in cultural evolution, written down in terms of their biological analogies, the biological language. The biological language is so well developed. There's such a tremendous discipline of Darwinian, near-Darwinian evolutionary theory, that all sorts of things like this can be written down in that way. Well, we could argue. I mean, one could go on in detail arguing about it, and this is what I wanted these pucker evolutionists to be here and argue with about, and then we would take on and say, but didn't you know that technological systems do these sorts of things? But it would take us a whole course of interesting lectures, which I'm sure some people would be happy to give if the LSE were to pay them the suitable fees to come and tell them all about these things. Okay, now, those are the analogies. I may say that this sort of thing has been talked about for ever since Darwin. One way or another, there have been suggestions along these lines. There's a whole literature of it. The fact that Karl Popper said he was going to be evolutionary epistemologist meant nothing, because he wasn't the first and certainly not the last to say this is the way in which we want to talk about philosophy or technology and so on. The interesting question I wanted to, the problem about this is that it doesn't work perfectly. And indeed, there are a number of disanalogies. It isn't such a word, a disanalogy, but my invention. Medieval, evolutionary, you may have. I mutate this particular theme and tell you that this is what I'm going to talk about. I've just announced. First of all, there are memes. A distressing word to many people, a distressing, I can't remember quite who invented it, and whoever invented it first wasn't the first to invent it, I think. It's probably. That is to say, the idea that in cultural, technological, philosophical evolution, there are analogies to genes, so to speak, a little elementary ideas or something which behave like the genes in genetic systems. Now, I'm going to accept that up to a point. I think it is rather useful in this to be able to talk about the ideas, the knowledge behind the artifact, or that is related to that. I think it is useful to talk about the meme of the wing as something which is useful for flying with. The meme of a radar system, which is a way of locating yourself. It's an idea which can be carried through in many different ways. And this goes down to all sorts of levels of detail. So it is useful to have that, well, even though one needs to be very careful with it, and I've just indicated why you've got to be very careful with it, because memes are not Mendelian. You can stretch it and you can argue it and you can hope that you got it, but I don't believe that you can really make convincing they are. They are imprecise defined, they are not articulate, and that's a very important point about the whole neo-Darwinian system, is the particulate nature of the gene. They are imperfectly replicable. As soon as I start talking about a wing, you start talking about, well, does it apply to, and so on, and you find that you run off into a whole lot of argument about it. And they are not necessarily long enduring in the sort of way that genes are in the Darwinian system. So that you really have to be very careful indeed. It's a disanalogy in the structural way. Second point I'd make is that the inheritance is not cladistic. You can have multiple parentage of technologies. I think we've already had some examples of that in the discussion. Yeah, and we're all very familiar with the idea that you can bring in ideas from very distant ones. Was it the Jamie we were talking about, Cameron, or was it the other lunch? I'm not sure. But if you take the sort of way in which the camcorder draws from a great many different traditions and brings them together in a way that is simply not true about any biological system. We cannot say that sharks and whales draw from the same stock of things, except very, very far back. They converge, but they're not actually a melding of the inheritance. You could have multiple parentage and distant lineages may recombine. So if you draw a picture of the way in which artifact, if you try to draw a chart of their family tree, it isn't a tree at all, it's a multiply connected network with lots of crossings, which would be impossible in a biological system. I don't know how far this actually upsets the whole system. And one of the interesting questions, and I pose this as a question probably to the computer simulation people, to say, is this an essential feature of the type of the phenomena, many of the phenomena of biological, of evolution systems, or is it one of the, is it just accidental to the biological case? It's not clear from the literature that I've come across whether it is that's an essential feature. The most obvious difference is that the technological evolution of artifact, is not Weismann. Question of whether it's Lamarckian is another question. Weismann was much clearer and more precise as to what exactly he was talking about, and what he was saying essentially was that the variations in the biological system are blind to the outcome. if an organism is born with a certain feature, mutant or recombined or whatnot, that feature is not actually built into it by the knowledge of what will actually come. I'm not saying that it can't happen to us. I'm not talking about the secondary and very important processes by which organisms are adapted to their life histories. That's another matter. I'm talking about the possibility of saying, goodness, I'm going to be an elephant, therefore I'm going to have a long trunk. That's just that sort of thing. Whereas we know that in technological systems, it is certainly possible for, and indeed absolutely normal, for the outcome of a variation to be foreseen by the inventor and therefore put into the variation. That is an enormous difference. Whether it makes a difference in the end to the processes, I don't know. And I'm waiting for these clever people with their computer system to tell us. Does it? I think there was some sign in some paper I read, but I don't know. I wouldn't know that. Very important for this discussion. And in fact, when we're talking about artifacts, we talk about something. We talk about the human psychology that's involved. We talk about things like memory and imagination playing a part in the creation of variants. Or, if we want to be a little more precise about it in terms of institutions, we have teleological and vicarious. Never mind, they're long words. But anyway, they're learning from experience and intentional design as characteristic features of artifactual evolution, which are not there in the biological case. I think the way to think about those is, I'm going to draw a little diagram about how one might think about those. I think that they actually are about time shifting. This is just a quirk, really, of an idea that I had about it, but I think that what they correspond to really is this, that because of the intervention of the human mind, and also, very importantly, of human social institutions like libraries and computers and a whole lot of other activities of this kind, we are able to mix into what's going on the invention process here, knowledge of the past through experience, tradition, memories, archives, and so on. So we learn from experience, to use that phrase. We can do trial and error, and then we don't repeat the same trial because we know that one worked. And we introduce those. We can, in a sense, learn from the future, because we can imagine and construct mental models of what that future will be like and carry out our processes accordingly. This is one of the reasons. Creativity, in a certain sense, is about that sort of thing, and all sorts of other things as well, but it has got that notion of, I am thinking of what it will be like when I have this thing completed, built, and not just built as it goes along. And of course, there's enough word prudence, which is part of the notion of being able to select in advance a successful design that will not have features that we would regard as disastrous. So that it's this time-shifting element in the process, which is characteristic of the technological evolution, which is not present in the biological. And not present. Whether that makes a difference in the evolutionary dynamics, I am not quite clear. Please do some work on that. There is a bit, I think, on it, but not much. Maybe very difficult to model, but it's an interesting point. Now, I want to shift into a slightly different which is to say, let's look at the actual technological innovation in a little bit more detail. Instead of treating it as a rather overall thing with all those artifacts, which I've already shown you, I want to
point out that there are actually about three different cycles of evolutionary process going on, three different universes or dimensions of variation and selection involved. And this is what makes it interesting, and one of them is the one that we're obviously, Lamarck. So those spark arresters were of that kind, weren't they? They appeared, and then the market selected them, and then there would be, you know, the ones that were successful were reproduced, and so on. Well, that's the obvious open process. But there is another process, which is something that goes on inside the innovatory system. Who was it? Ricard, were you talking about the R&D systems, the way in which innovation are actually internalized into institutions and are carried out there before they go into the market? And this is where things like research, development, design, demonstration come in, theoretical simulations, vicarious selection. Vicarious selection means selection in terms of some property that you think will do in place of the reality of the marketplace, does it appeal to the boss's wife, the shape, or something? It, therefore, if we're beautiful, one will be successful, and things like that. Yeah, I can see my lady friends objecting to possibly coming slant to that, but I only wanted to show that
we
there
just
are a number
the
of...
The boss's husband.
What?
We thought it might appeal to the boss's husband.
What I wanted to say is, what happens there is that you have a process of variation, selection, retention, an evolutionary process, in which the objects that are being selected are what I call virtual artifacts. A virtual artifact being something like a blueprint, a plan, a design, something, parts of a system, a model, a simulation, a prototype, all those different things that are not actually the things you're going to put on the market yet, but which you circulate around and discuss and vary and argue about before you actually produce the actual artifact. Now that is a process which can, I think the people who talk and discuss creativity, where are you, Maggie? Yes, would say goes on very much inside the mind of the inventor. There's a lot of processes of that kind going on in the creative inventive mind. New ideas coming up, being selected out, rejected, and so on, and a process going on there. And one of the interesting things is that in the modern inventive institutions, this is actually institutionalized, so a lot of people are involved in it. It becomes a social process rather than an internal psychological process. But I think there's more to it than that. And this is the process which the existence of what I call the techno-science community. That is to say, the people who, the professors of technology, the engineers, the engineering journals, there's a whole tremendous activity going on in which ideas are mostly are being transmitted and selected. You get an evolution of concepts as distinct from the evolution of the actual design inside the factory and so on. And that is something that I've tried to draw. My computer graphics really sometimes do all right, but that's the best I can do for that one. That, in other words, you see you're getting a process in which an idea of a new type of wing, to give an example, there's a brilliant discussion of this in Vincenzi's book on this. The idea of a new type of wing, a theory of it, gets distributed around in the aeronautical community, and then various people take it up and say, well, they argue about it and discuss it, and they have a whole lot of variation and selection in terms of the theory of wings before they actually build it. Okay, try it out, one that I think is successful, and make it into a virtual artifact, to say, discuss it in the thing, and actually turn it into an artifact on the market. So that the overall process of technological evolution in our time is now very much more complicated in that sort of way. And I do not believe that it's possible to discuss this subject seriously, to do research on it properly, unless one takes into account all these different elements, all these different types of selection and variation process.
Well now, where do we go from there? Well, one thing we do, I think, is this. We see that the biological analogy is dangerous. The biological analogy has got so many disanalogies in it. There are so many features of the technological system that are not present in biological systems and vice versa, that we need to be very careful indeed in using analogical, metaphorical arguments any further than in the loosest way. And this, I think, has been the great block in the development of this subject. The more the books I read on this, they start off very nicely and say, look at all these beautiful analogies and so on, and we can show you all these phenomena. And then they stop. They say, we don't know how to go on any further. And then they say, well, they weakly say, well, of course, really, it's Lamarckian, isn't it, or something like that, and then they stop. And so I think that somehow or another we've got to go a little further. If we're going to make further progress in this, then we need to do something else. And one of the openings that we could exploit is the existence of a different system which actually has evolutionary, emergent, etc. properties. And there we do have those in the computer simulation. I don't give a fig as to whether they are called life or not, or artificial, or whether they're going to come alive and eat us all up, I'm not sure. All of that sort of thing seems to be really not very important to the particular point we're making here, which is that if you set up a rather narrowly defined, very precise mathematical model of something which interacts and does some of the things which I've defined in the structural analogies there, then, by golly, it changes in ways that are remarkably like those of biological and technological and other evolution systems. And here was actually a list of the properties that I discovered in reading the literature on the computer simulations. And I found that there were phenomenological similarities to known biological evolutionary phenomena occurring apparently in these systems. And my suggestion, my major theoretical methodological suggestion here, a theoretical method in here, is to move away from the biological systems in this case. Regard the biological systems as a particular manifestation of a variation, selection, replication system, but to move perhaps to slightly more abstract and formalized systems and look at their properties and use them as your primary analogy before and ask, do they actually behave in that way? This is that's the message. That's methodological message. Now, I just want today. I think perhaps I'll just put this up now to say, I don't want to go on too long, where does this all lead? What is the point of all of this sort of thing? Why do this, etc.? There are so many people who ask these things, and really it's such a lovely subject, I can't even imagine why anyone should need to have to ask why such daunting and puzzling questions that seem to be implied in this discussion shouldn't stimulate people quite sufficiently without asking why should we do research on this, what comes out of it. But here I just made a few ideas of it. One is that I've already made the remark about the role of computer simulation in here, and in particular I think that sort of rather tantalizing remark whether life is a complex system at the edge of chaos might be a very interesting way of looking at technological innovation, and so on. That's the high theory stuff, for those who like it. For those of us who are
involved in the study of technological innovation as such, I believe that there are a number of important lessons. I think we've already heard some of those ideas from Jamie and Rickard. There's a question of whether there are historical trends from the selection to design types of mechanisms, whether the to look at the Darwinian or other processes in the laboratory and in the marketplace, a sort of micro studies of these things, just what's going on in there, suggests that. The question of variations between industries, Rickard talked about drugs, but I think Jamie talks about the robots, microchips. There are a number of different types of innovation system, each of which might well have its different type of evolutionary structures and mechanisms. What are the selection criteria in the marketplace? People argue, oh, well, never mind, there's a whole lot of argument about this, and it's one of those things that really needs to be worked up, and it needs to be worked up within a framework of proper evolutionary selectionist theory, and not just in a sort of oversimplified version of those things. And finally, and perhaps this is the sort of thing that appeals to people nowadays, techno-science policy, foresight theories, foresight, etc. Bob Whelan and I were discussing that just now. If one looks at that sort of thing from this perspective, within this paradigm, ought those who say things about what sort of science policies we ought to have, go on saying them if they realize that this is actually a more rational perspective on it than the big systems, rational design, etc., a type of approach, which is so typical of many people in this field. And finally, and here in some ways I feel the most interesting and subtle of all the research sites there, is the point that was made very strongly by Jamie Fleck, which is that in fact the socio-economic environment of technological innovation is absolutely fundamental. That in that you have in fact the co-evolution of artifacts with their institutions. That it's not just the firm that produces a range of changing artifacts, but the firm itself is changing as it produces new artifacts and has to change along with them, it has to evolve with them, and all the processes of evolution are involved there. And there's another subtle side to this, and which is this. Jamie has taken that point up, I agree with him. I think I'm on his side on this. Artifacts as characteristic cultural objects. They have an enormous advantage, which is that they are there, solid, and you can actually study them concretely. And here is this glass, and it is a cultural artifact, and it is not. It has certain properties of solidity. I won't break that, but I could, which are not present, for example, in the words that I have been saying about the theory that I have about the way in which cultural development. There is a certain, it's the concreteness and materiality of them, which makes them useful objects of study, useful parts of the study. And you might think, oh, well, anybody can talk about them. Why don't we talk about real culture, which is ideas, ideologies, political theories, institutions, etc.? In essence, however, an artifact is all of those things. An artifact is a cultural object. It has the attributes of all cultural objects. It is an institution. This is not just an object, a material object. It is attached to it, all the meanings around it. Just it is much an object, much a cultural entity as, for example, the Roman Catholic Mass, which is the sort of thing people might talk about as an evolution thing. It happens to be one of the things that is used in the Roman Catholic Mass, but it also is the same sort of thing. It belongs in the world of culture. It is not in the same world as rocks and stones, or indeed of cats and dogs. It is a cultural object, and therefore things that you understand about its evolution may help you to understand, plot out certain charts and maps for the evolution of the much more subtle and evanescent types of cultural objects which people spend so much of their time studying, particularly, I suspect, in this revered institution. Thank you.
As I explained before, we'll go straight ahead with the second talk and have opportunities for questioning John Zimmerman later. Our second speaker is Richard Webb, who also, like me actually, has the immense privilege and advantage of being a real biologist, trained, he tells me, or at least influenced by that wicked person, Richard Dawkins. However, I have to say, Richard, that he does seem to have gone in the wrong direction. Seems to have started as a zoologist and sunk to becoming a student of technology rather than the other way around, like proper people like me. But never mind, he does actually have feet in both camps. And if I have a piece of paper, I'll tell you what he's going to talk about. He's going to talk to us about fossil soup, the evolution of technology, life as we know it, or a prebiotic soup, Richard.
Well, I think I'm here as the token biologist of the occasion, and I'd like to start by thanking John, but saying that I believe that his reports of the death of the biological analogy are somewhat exaggerated. So I'd like to say one or two things on behalf of the biologists and Darwinians. I'm particularly grateful to Ricard for a line he's given me to get started with. He said, "If you're a Darwinian, certain things follow. If you're not a Darwinian, you have more degrees of freedom to model things in different ways." Unfortunately, I misunderstood, I misheard him, and I thought he said, "You have more degrees of freedom to muddle things in different ways." And I do think that a test for Darwinism and a test for the biological analogy are whether they can help one get through the muddle that currently surrounds the evolution of technology. So I'm a biologist, I'm a Darwinist, a hardcore Darwinist, and I don't make any apology for that, but one or two people in the room may wish to preface some of the things that I say with, "If you want to say it this way, then I suppose." I didn't mishear John earlier talking about PACA evolutionists. I think that was right, wasn't it? I see technology as a biologist should see technology, an array of a natural history, if you like, of different forms and complex interacting systems. And I think just as with biology and the biological phenomena, this is amenable to investigation using scientific techniques. Darwinism has sorted out biology, and it may be of some help to technology. When I stopped being a biologist, and in fact when I gave up working for a large technological company, I went off to set up in business. I went off to set up in business as, well, they were concerned I might be a potential competitor. And so this large company threw the book at me, quite politely, and they've sent me the little letter that said, "For people leaving, would you like to be sure that you have not inadvertently taken away with you certain pieces of paper that carry information? Would you like to check in your, etc.?" Very nice. And they also said to me, "You do realize the rules about intellectual property." And I had a bit of a chat about intellectual property because I know about patents. You know, you can write down ideas and things as patents. I know about copyright. Even though you've read a book, it doesn't belong to you. Even if it's in your head, it doesn't belong to you. You're not allowed to spread it around. It's copyrighted. I know about designs being registered and so on. But I hadn't really realized the extent to which know-how is under the control of large technological organizations. And quite a lot of things in my head belonged to this company. And they made it very plain that they belonged to the company and I was very restricted in what I could do with them. And these were ordinary practices for running ordinary things. They weren't things that had been written down as patents. And even some of them I'd made up myself, I'd invented them, and yet they belonged to the company and it was there in the contract. And this was no more than I should have expected, because I do see technology as a whole as being made up of these fragments, if you like, of ideas, of notions, of practices, of processes of doing things. I'm going to introduce the word meme, which I think may lead to one or two sharp intakes of breath. Let's just leave that aside for the moment. If we use the analogy of meme being a unit of this information, an algorithm, if you like, or an instruction, or a piece of information, or an idea, something vague and notional, if we look at these memes, then we find that they actually exist in different forms. They exist in your head, and may or may not belong to you. They exist in the spoken word, which is bouncing around this room. They exist in books, and they exist in artifacts or institutions. I must take myself an institution of water. They exist in different stages, in different forms, in different styles. And some of them have persisted an awfully long time, and others haven't. Their expression is highly dependent on the physical context they're in, and it's highly dependent on the medium. It's highly dependent on the other memes that are around it. So I'd like to say that as a Darwinist, technology's memes can be said to satisfy the basic criteria for Darwinian evolution. And I don't think it's very difficult to define the basics, and I would say that mutation, recombination, replication, and selection are what counts. If that's going on, you're in with a real chance of Darwinian evolution happening. And it clearly happens. I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on it. You think of the memes incorporated in this glass, that they could have been in somebody's head, they could have been changed by mutation, mistakes made that led to better kinds of glass or worse. This includes a number of new memes, memes that have been brought together in new ways, recombination. It's been copied. Look, there's four or five copies on this table here. And it's been selected according to the marketplace or according to design criteria or the husband or the boss or whatever. So this is happening to these memes. They're a bit notional, but they are undergoing these basic four dimensions of Darwinian selection and evolution. Listening to the talks today, if we look at the overall evolution of technology, taking a grandstand view and looking back at it, there are clearly two quite different kinds of things happening, and they're terribly fuzzily overlapped, but let's take them as two. One is intentional design, where a person is looking at an endpoint, a goal, is trying to achieve it, is trying to put together ideas in a way that will satisfy a certain problem. And there's a whole lot of other influences that are not intentional, that may be to do with sociology or countries being successful or failing or whatever. And I'd like to look at intentional design first. It does tend to be rather limited, intentional design. I mean, we all have examples of the big atom bomb program or the building of the Channel Tunnel or whatever, and these are seen as huge programs devoted to achieving an end. But actually, most technology isn't like that, and even the Channel Tunnel is a bit of a one-off. And over a short time scale, a few brains, usually just one, comes together and creates a particular, achieves a particular goal or doesn't. If lots of people are doing this, then there will be unintended consequences. That's inevitable. If lots of cooks are choosing good recipes, then there will be a change in the pattern of recipes. There will be a change in things will happen across a larger scale. And so some of that will be because they make mistakes, and some of that will be because there is a sort of invisible hand operating. And those who were listening to the talk a couple of weeks ago about science as being a domain within which invisible hands can operate constructively would understand the connection there. So although there is intentional evolution happening, there is actually quite a lot of intentional design happening. There's quite a lot of unintentional evolution that is coming out of it. I would argue, and this is an assertion, that anything that is that contains things that look like memes that are following the four basic dimensions of Darwinian evolution are likely
to be evolving. Given some continuity, and we've got some continuity, and certain necessary conditions, and perhaps we need to do John's computer simulations to find out a bit more about the initial conditions, but given certain circumstances, we should expect to find evolution in a system like this. Even if everybody is terribly good at the intentional part of it and is directing their own lives in a very effective way, we would still expect there to be a sort of default mechanism of Darwinism. I think it's testable. I think it's testable in a number of ways, but the obvious way is by the biological analogy, by comparing the patterns that you see in life, which is the one system we know absolutely for sure has evolved by natural selection, and comparing that with technology. Now, there's a little sort of twist in the tail, because we all know the answer is that it doesn't work terribly well, but the twist in the tail, it says, except where specific contingencies do not obtain, which I'm told is philosophical speak for unless you've got some excuse or other. John has explained that at first glance, the patterns of the evolution of whatever it is, a camcorder or an overhead projector or a bicycle, looks remarkably like the evolution of the horse, and they're even strung up in museums in much the same sort of way. But when you look at it more closely, the thing falls apart. You can't see that this individual here is the great-grandchild of this individual here, even though you can find apparently homologous elements to it, and you can look at some sort of progress and increasing or decreasing complexity. When you look at it, that they haven't descended, even if they belonged in the same company, made by the same company, they haven't descended in any sensible, in any way that you can stick with. We've heard about the discussion of the unit of selection and the unit of replication. I mean, it is terribly unclear as to how this thing would breed if it did breed, and it's very unclear about what the blueprint would be, what the genetic code might be. And if we are comparing horses with overhead projectors, we would find ourselves very quickly running into the kind of trouble that John has been illustrating. But I would like to argue that life as we know it, which is what biologists are interested in, is a bit of a special case, as John has said, that in no way undermines the argument for there being a Darwinian force, a Darwinian explanation behind technology, the evolution of technology. If we run through the list there, you can say that almost everything that would be considered pretty basic to life or any comparison with life, like the notion of the individual or the distinction between genotype, phenotype, the genetic code, inheritance mechanisms, species, the fact that you pick up and touch something that's alive, all of those fundamentals are actually quite late evolutionary developments or adaptations in the history of life. Now, we really only tend to call things alive once they've satisfied these certain criteria, but they started somewhere. Running through them, I mean, the individual is not an individual. It's a cooperative. It's a cooperation of genes and of subgenes and of organelles and God knows what. There's a real mishmash there. The phenotype and the genotype do have exceptions. It is quite difficult to use that language when you get down inside a chromosome and you're talking about some elements of the genetic material there. What is the phenotype of one of those parasitic DNAs? And so on. The unit of selection, it's now the gene, things are stabilized a bit, and we're pretty clear it's the gene, but it may not always have been, and in fact there is the potential for selection to be happening at every level. People keep looking for it happening at group selection level, because theoretically it ought to be able to. It just doesn't happen to very much. So what I'd like to suggest to resurrect the biological analogy is that I'll leave that to one side, is that we have a look at the so-called prebiotic soup. For those who are not familiar with this is the stuff that was around before things became alive. And it was around for quite a long time, 300, 400 million years. So if we say that we can't make good comparisons with life as we know it, because life is a highly evolved, highly contingent system, technology hasn't been around very long, we want a practical comparison. Why not go for prebiotic soup, for the kinds of complex systems that were around before things that we recognize as life appeared. This stuff was clearly evolving by natural selection. There is no other possible explanation. And it's not remotely controversial to say that. It started from something. It started from mud and water and boiling whatnot. And it must have had quite a complicated mixture of evolving systems, complex reactions, cycling, wandering equations that came back with similar patterns. The replicators and so on were very far from being clearly defined. And the early codes were not what we have now. It was not a triplet DNA code. It wasn't digital. Can't have been. I mean, that's just ludicrously unlikely. That is the outcome of quite a long period of evolution. If it lasted for 300 million years, which is one of the estimates, I'm indebted to Colin Tudge at the back here for one of these analogies for trying to compress long periods of time into intervals that we can cope with. If you take an armful of books, 2 meters of books, stacked up next to each other, and take that as 300 million years, neatly defined, a history of the prebiotic soup that started with hot rocks and ended with wriggly things, you find actually that technology only occupies the time, if it's 10, 100,000, doesn't really matter. If it's 500,000 years, it only occupies a page or two at the beginning of that. We're not talking about a great deal of time that the process has been running here on Earth. It's exploded in the last century. That's a paragraph or less. There is no great length of time that has passed. We wouldn't have expected all the lifelike specificities to have appeared. So what? Why is that interesting apart from a hardline biologist saying there's life in the argument yet? I'd like to offer a suggestion that the Darwinian approach, the Darwinian mechanism, if we understand it, is actually quite helpful in a practical sense, in that it helps us manage technology. People who manage technology are those who run labs or design recipes or run R&D departments or put together grant proposals. Those people have the basic four levers of power to operate if it's a Darwinian process, and they can go with those. They can manage mutation, or recombination, or replication, or selection. Any mix of those. And that will shape them, that will allow them to direct evolution of technology towards the ends that they want. So this is a form of directed evolution, which is open to any of us who want to use this in our own lives, and it's only really clear that these are the main implements to use if you accept the Darwinian argument. I rest my case.
And we have you up here too, John. We now have just a bit over half an hour for discussion, questions and so on. I would ask you, when you ask a question, be audible, because I'm getting deaf. Give us your name and affiliation. And ask a question, but really only in the sense of those persons that one sees on their telly saying, would not the minister accept that he's a bloody idiot? You know, that kind of question will be acceptable. The only other thing I will say is that I'm not only deaf, I'm myopic. If you wish me to pay attention to you, it's no good just going like that, you'll have to. Okay? First question. Yeah, Gary
Ransom from Cambridge. So I'm a sociologist, who, unlike most, such has absolutely no problem about memes, as long as you don't look too hard for discrete particles of information. Seems to be the best going definition in the conscious selection world, bundles of information affecting phenotype. And equally, I'm not worried by the disanalogies, because it's the analogies which are the important ones. And I think that came out very well. I'm extremely sympathetic, I have to say, just in case you think that those other sociologists follow that I'm not. But one question to you both, please. What are memes selected for?
Well, which would you like to get first? John, you were first.
Well, I mean, it is as the wise candidate says, or the wise speaker and they have to ask questions like that. That's a good question. I'm glad you asked me that. Honestly, I don't know, and I'm not going to try and argue it out now, because I think these are the sorts of questions we do. I'm going to hold back from trying to answer questions that take a long time and I don't know the answers to. If you want to have a go,
I'm not sure it is a good question. I think that when you're talking about memes, if you're wearing your selfish gene hat and your modern biology hat, you really can't use words like for. The memes exist out there, like genes exist out there, and their relative numbers and frequencies change as a result of a number of things going on. And selection is one of the things that limits the rate of their spread and that cuts them back. They are selected, they change their frequency. And if we aren't doing anything about it, they will still change their frequency and they will still be selected. So memes are selected, full stop. If we want to change the number of and relative frequencies of the memes out there, then we have to select them in particular ways, and we do that using artificial constructs like the marketplace or like religions or something like that.
I mean, I don't know if the chairman would like to answer questions, probably not, but I mean, I think I'm agreeing with you.
Please do,
I mean,
yes.
After all, I mean, if you ask what a gene selected for, you say genes either replicate fast or they don't. When we say the gene is replicated for, what we mean is there are more copies of that gene in the future than there were in the past. I guess that's what you would say of a meme, is it?
I think you have to, and I think that the kind of metaphor language that people have come to use in biology, when they talk about genes for this and genes for that, which is beginning to get people into some difficulty, gets you quite hopelessly out of your depth immediately when you talk about memes for this and memes for that. There are memes, and the memes have different forms, and the forms have different effects.
I think what this raises is, what are the mechanisms that actually take place when things do get reproduced and so on? What are the criteria, what happens in them? And that's what the question implies, and of course they are extremely heterogeneous, extremely diverse, and by no means necessarily for the furtherance of the life of the community or whatever other broad thing you have. That would be the sort of...
If I could raise my lingering discontent in the form of a question, I'd be right in there, but I can't. And so if I feel that I make a speech, I'll not shut up.
There's someone right at the back.
Stephen Leiden from University. Well, I'm an archaeologist, and we've been studying artifacts for many, many years, and I've been slightly disconcerted with the two talks just now, and then before tea, in the sense that you seem to be taking the characteristics of technological evolution as we see in modern, late industrial, Western society with the marketplace, and saying, well, this is what technological evolution is about throughout, since we've been having technology, and it's not a few thousand years, it's several million years. So I'm just wondering whether you're trying to develop models for technological evolution just in this cultural context of Western industrial society with the marketplace, with the techno-science community, with technology managers, I think you use, or whether you are indeed trying to talk about technological evolution in a far more general sense, which in the case where we may see very different processes happening in different times. And indeed, if we look back into prehistory, we may find some of the disanalogies between technological evolution and biological evolution becoming rather less important in the sense of innovation, creativity, design, perhaps are playing far less important roles when you look at pre-modern humans. Mm. So I'm really wondering what you mean by technological evolution in terms of this
That's another good question, in that sense. But in fact, one of the projects that I have in mind in this particular area is to ask anthropologists who are familiar with the processes that take place in, shall I call them, primitive communities, that is, less ones that are much less sophisticated in these processes.
I'm going to be separating anthropologists, but...
Sorry?
I don't want to use the phrase primitive.
No, I know that. I'm not. I don't want to be PC about it. I'm sorry. What I'm saying is that there are, in fact, different ways in which the evolution takes place of artifacts in different societies, and to see to what extent there is, in fact, an admixture of for example, the phase of the virtual artifact, the social things, and so on, and thus to plot out perhaps the changes in the process over different societies and over different periods. I think this is exactly the sort of question to raise.
I'd like to comment that I think any mechanism that can only explain technology in recent times is not a satisfactory one, that we're looking for something that would explain technology among people 3 million years ago and technology among blue tits. It doesn't really matter. It ought to be something that underlies the overall process. And I'm sorry if I've become contaminated by that kind of capitalist milieu.
Richard, you said the first thing that I disagreed with. However,
yes.
Yeah, I'm Ken Binmore from University College London. I actually have a series of questions. The first question is really how we try to run before we can crawl. It seems to me before we venture, study innovation and invention, perhaps we should begin by looking at simple models of imitation. First question. And then, given that we're going to do that, is it really useful to insist on the word Darwinian? About is creating the market.
Speak up.
Yeah, second question. I agree that we should, with the speakers earlier, that we should model a meme as a strategy plus the context in which it is to be applied. And of course, this is also the same of behavioral properties in biology. But when we start thinking about disanalogies, is the disanalogy so very strong? Behavioral strategy in the biological sense is not determined in general by a single gene. So is it really true that the gene package which determines the behavior is indeed precisely defined? It seems to me it's actually imprecisely defined. Is it perfectly replicable? No, in fact, it's imperfectly replicable. Is it long enduring? Well, what long enduring means depends on the rate of selection. Rate of selection for memes is obviously much faster than for genes. So it's not at all clear to me, certainly in evolutionary game theory, what actually happens is it's assumed that the phenotype is transmitted. That's functionally what happens. And when there are genuine disanalogies, it seems to me they're very favorable to modeling. I mean, for example, the cladistic case. We can well do without the cladistic assumption when it comes to modeling. And if there's no sex, it makes life a lot easier too. And in fact, as an economist, I know of a number of simple examples of imitation modeled in continuous time, which actually produce the replicated dynamics, which was first invented by biologists. In many cases, the replicated dynamics converge on evolutionary stable strategies. So we actually have, in some cases, suitable models. And last thing I want to ask, I know I'm cheating on the question.
Speak loudly, will you? I'm not
last
sure
thing on the questions. Do we really want to rely on computer simulations? Because the history is not very good. I mean, we have Axelrod's simulations, which are still quoted over and over and over again, although they've been shown to be, the conclusions are basically incorrect. Genetic algorithms, disastrous failure when used to model updating in interactive situations in interactive learning. No, I mean, it's true that there are things to be learned from simulation, but it isn't a substitute, it seems to me, for scientific work.
Oh, simulations are scientific work.
As Chairman, I think I'm going to ration our two speakers to only one of Ken Binmore's questions each. I mean, pick whichever thing you thought he said was wrongest and comment on that. And will you do the same, John?
Yeah, okay.
Because otherwise we can be too long on one.
Of course.
As I agree with your second two, I shall pick the first one. You said run before we can walk, and why not look at models of imitation? Well, the models of imitation is one element of the transmission of the inheritance mechanism of memes within technology. I was rereading, dipping back into Gilbert White the other day, the man who invented natural history, so to speak. And they really were seriously wrong back then about what the swallows did in winter and this sort of thing. But he was muddling around and trying to get some sort of pattern and some sort of picture out of it. And I think if he'd devoted his life to working out just one of the little elements of the problem, he wouldn't have taken things forward as much as he could have done. I think that what the area needs is clarity across the whole, accepting that the pieces will be put in by detailed modelling of imitation and retention of artifact, all the elements of it. There is a conceptual structure that's missing.
John, one of the points.
Yes, I agree with you. Well, most of the things you said were good questions and interesting contributions to the discussion. Darwinism and Lamarckism. I think it is rather useful to have some sort of terminology. My view is that one can use the word Darwinism in relation to the random variation selection things, more or less as Darwin himself was putting them, where he didn't say very much about what the sources of variation were, and so on. There's a sort of classical type of thing which didn't actually have genetics much in it. I think I prefer to use neo-Darwinism when you actually put in, that's right, isn't it, when you actually put the genes in and start saying that's the genes that are being selected and in a that sort of precise way. I think we do need to have some sort of language, some sort of terminology for the cases where there is this non-Weismannian factor of the time forward, time back, etc. And to use quotes, query, Lamarckism, unquotes, as a signal of that is the nearest I can get to it. Of course, it is a very different indeed from what Lamarck has said, or is said to have said, or believed to have said, or is attributed, etc., etc., all of those things. But that's a useful, it's simply a code for the moving away from the Weismannian type of situation.
You wanted a question? Would you mind standing up and talking to them rather than to us so that they can...
Yeah. Embarrassing, yes. Sue Lightwater from Bristol. I will do that. I really liked your question, John, about back to this Weismannian thing. If I understand it right, you were saying, does it really matter that as far as genes are concerned, they have no foresight, they can't see into the future, but as far as memes are concerned, we as the guardians of memes, or the owners of memes or whatever, have real foresight, real intentionality, you know, make conscious decisions and so on. I would like to ask whether that's really true. I would suggest that, in fact, making that assumption is immediately leading us astray. I would go along with Dennis and many other people who say that when we think we're making conscious decisions, when we think we're having true intentionality, we're just, after the fact, telling ourselves a story of that kind. And, in fact, we might find, if we dropped that false story, we could see that what's going on with memes is exactly what's going on with genes. They're blind, they're driving the thing from underneath, and we're just sitting here on the top telling ourselves a false story and thinking that we understand it. So my suggestion is if we drop that, we wouldn't even ask your question. Instead of saying, does it matter that they're different, we might say, oh, hang on a minute, are they actually the same?
Your assertion is that I'm a lumbering robot programmed by my meat.
Yes, exactly. Telling yourself a story that you're a real conscious human being in charge of your life.
Okay.
That's which we would like to comment on.
Yeah, well, that is a question on which I have given some thought, because I have read a certain amount of the literature on evolutionary epistemology, which essentially takes this view. It's a sort of a general philosophy of nature and of humanity and everything else, which says in the end it's all a sort of Darwinian or a process going on underneath. I don't disagree with that, but the trouble is it's one of those generalized statements that are of a philosophical kind that are almost vacuous, because it really doesn't tell you any more. And I prefer here, in this particular discussion, to black box that level of discussion and say, I'm going to take it that we are dealing with human beings and human mind which have certain capabilities, more or less of these kinds of memory, etc., in them. And although, indeed, if I were a psychologist and if I were a brain scientist and if I were a molecular biologist and if I were, in fact, a quantum chemist, I might see at each level all these other things going on. I think it's convenient and it's good scientific practice to not to bring them into the discussion, but to try to limit yourself to a certain range. For goodness sake, it's difficult enough without putting that all in.
I would agree. I do think memes are blind, but I think that one of the difficulties people have with memes is that memeologists or whatever, meme ethicists, what they tend to define memes as encompassing everything. And I prefer to think of memes that satisfy the same sort of criteria that genes satisfy, that they are obeying those four dimensions. And so not everything is a meme. There are memes out there. We do have some power to shift and move them around. We organize ourselves into teams to move them into different combinations. And I think that we have some control over that. I agree, I think we have much less than we'd like to tell ourselves. And it's funny how often a good idea attracts inventors after the event.
From both the biological and technological sides, there's been a lot of interest in looking at either history or the history of technology or the history of nature about the nature of this process of change over time. Does it represent progress, for example? Clearly, history of technology has placed a lot of emphasis on progress, and Darwinian theory was very much attached to a notion of progress. Now, I notice no one's mentioned it this afternoon, so the question is just to confirm that this has been abandoned by both sides to this discussion. I mean, John mentioned there's a distinction between the technological sphere and the biological, that in a sense one could retrieve the past in technology, that there were previous expressions of technology which may not have been selected for at some moment in the past, it might actually be selected for now. Human powered transport, renewable energy sources. One can think of a number of areas of technology where the selection environment becomes more favourable to retrieving these from the past. The equivalent, presumably, is the fossil record, and whether that's retrievable or whether it simply represents an early stage in the process of progressive historical change. So my question is, have both the technological analysts and the biologists abandoned the notion of progress? And is this a serious difference about the ability to retrieve the past between the two parties?
Whichever first, I'd like to say.
I'm not sure that I have a very sort of clear position on it. I think progress is one of those words you don't use very often because you tend to get jumped on. But inevitably, progress does happen in an evolutionary sense. As you build up incrementally, you are able to get into new domains and find new potential design possibilities that you couldn't before. And so there's some sense of progress there. I think that wearing a British industry hat, I think a lot of people in our Western civilization have made serious errors about progress. They thought that if you could design better performance from an engineering point of view into something, it will therefore succeed better in the marketplace. And as a result, lots of people have lost their jobs. And that's partly because they've been engineers and they haven't understood that an artifact in a marketplace has to have other attributes like somebody to buy it and the right price and it's time bound and so on. So you can have progress that leads to failure, and I think that people need to be careful with progress.
When I was starting to read up this sort of stuff, sorry, I don't mean to denigrate it, but I'm having to read things like John Maynard Smith's book and books on evolution and books on, and your book too, Helena, so don't you blush about it. All sorts of books of this kind. I came across this word progress with a lot of question marks attached to it and difficulties and so on, very proper difficulties concerned with what criteria you use and what is the meaning of it. And so it seemed to me that it wasn't perhaps a very useful operational concept in this particular type of discussion. I did actually have it on my side. It was one of the analogies, as a matter of fact. I mean, if you want to talk about biological process, progress in the sorts of ways that you do, and there are ways of talking about it quite properly and usefully and constructively, then you can equally talk about technological progress in rather analogous ways. There isn't an enormous difficulty doing that. Whether, in fact, you can do the thing that people are talking about, which is somehow or other to engineer your way, to undo, to avoid blocks or something, you know, get into some other realm, and that this is a new, you know, humanity can shape its own system, etc. That sort of way of talking, I'm very skeptical about. That would seem to me to be the dangerous idea about progress as it came out of a positivist science of the and technology of the 19th century. Somehow man can do his own thing and he can engineer his own life, and in this sense progress is the end of progress, because like history, you make it do what you want. That, I'm sure, is not the message at all of this. On the contrary, it would deny that real possibility there. Now, these are the sorts of things that go around there, but I wouldn't like to. No, need an essay. We'll have an essay competition for that.
I'd be tempted, if I may, to again take a chairman's privilege and say what biologists, I think, ought to think about progress. What they actually think, I don't know. I think we've been a bit brainwashed on this issue by the sort of politically correct. You know, just as somebody earlier was threatening us for using the word primitive. The reason evolutionary biologists have been worried by the notion of progress is that there's nothing in Darwinian theory which says that every lineage has to get more complicated, let alone better, whatever better might mean. And indeed, most evolutionary lineages do not get more complicated, and a great many of them do absolutely damn well for millions of years at a time. So what we are right to reject is the kind of, it really is actually a Lamarckian idea. It's a central notion that Lamarck had, far more than any idea about heredity, namely that life has some kind of inbuilt tendency to go on and on and up and up. That's wrong. But on the other hand, it would be foolish not to see some directionality on the grand scale. I mean, it would be very odd if the first things in the fossil record were elephants and oak trees, let alone human beings, and you finished up with a fossil record which contained nothing but bacteria. I mean, it isn't like that, it's the other way around. It has an obvious directionality about it, and that directionality requires explanation. It's a real problem, and I agree with John, it is an analogy, no more perhaps, but it is an analogy with what happens in technology. Sorry, there were a number of hands up. You've been trying a long time.
I've forgotten about the Open University. Just to think about the arguments that have been put forward to us in this second session, I think it's been registered that we need to be wary of the biological theory applied to technology, and then we've been told we need to be wary of applying the biological analogy to biological systems, so hence we need to apply the biological analogy to prebiotic, non-biological systems. So is it still a biological analogy? And does it go back to the point made earlier that we're really talking about abstract models of how systems change? And that leads me to think of how ecosystems, what's the evolutionary pattern of ecosystems? What is the evolutionary pattern of the universe, even? And, do these general ideas offer insights into technological change, taking us away from the more specific features of biological evolution?
Quickly, this is for you primarily, I think.
I'd like to put a slide back up and just see if I can talk to that. The hypothesis, the proposition is that there's a Darwinian process underlying the evolution of technology. And if you want to test that, I believe it is testable, it's not metaphysical, it is testable. And one way to test it is to compare it with another system which you know has been generated by the same mechanism. And life is the only other system that we know about that has been generated by that mechanism. So there is power to be had from comparing it with that. The but is that, but a lot of things in life and a lot of things in biologists' traditional approaches to studying biology are much more to do with the specific case of life as we know it, and not to do with the fact that the underlying mechanism is Darwinian. So we need to pick our examples quite carefully from life if we're going to use that as the comparison.
Gentleman in the green polo in the back. Yeah.
Paddy Davis from Warwick. In terms of the analogy between biological and technological evolution, I was wondering if there's something in virtue of which, selection mechanism. Is there anything about the selection mechanism that would mean that the overall process would be still evolutionary? Or are there selection mechanisms that you could have in the whole thing? You'd still say things were being selected, but you wouldn't be able to get an evolutionary count of the overall process off the ground.
I think this is the sort of question of which I feel that the computer simulation specialists could help us. I feel that there are ways in which they might change the rules, so to speak, and see whether there is whether they do make a difference. There's a lot of interesting discourse on the subject of fitness landscapes, the possible ways in which, what sort of jumps you would need to make, what sort of variations, what sort of rules of selection would give you change of this kind. And I think that there is at least some sort of intellectual universe one could enter in there. It's a complicated one. I can see Ken Binmore shaking his head vigorously about all this, but I think that actually there is some interesting work that could be done there, and I can't see how you can do it in any other way except by looking at the effects of their effects on a artificial system that you've engineered to do this sort of thing. I cannot imagine how you could do it in any other way, or maybe some bacteria or another. Very difficult problem.
I should perhaps explain as a chairman that it is my intention to introduce Maggie Bowden and Ken Binmore to one another over drinks. I shall ring a bell, and then I shall ring another bell after 3 minutes. And we shall have a real discussion then about whether computer simulation is of any use.
To give my opinion on your question about selection, I think selection is necessary but not sufficient for evolution. But I'd far rather hear John Maynard Smith's answer.
Well, you've got to have heredity or nothing happens. I mean, it's as simple as that, essentially. That's the one thing you've got to have in there before it's interesting. You've been trying to ask a question for some time, I'm sorry.
It's yeah. Richard Webb. I didn't understand the analogy, or maybe more than analogy, to technology and prebiotic soup. As I understand it, this was essentially a system of replicators without phenotypes. There wasn't a phenotype-genotype distinction, but I can't think of artifacts, if we're going to take artifacts as the sort of focus of technological investigation, how you can conceive of those as replicators, since they don't contain the requisite information to replicate themselves. They have to be extended phenotypes in the sense of dogs, like bands of beavers. They are constructs of human beings. And how would the prebiotic analogy work in that condition?
I have to admit, the prebiotic analogy is a convenient black box. It's a way of saying it doesn't fit with life for all these reasons. There was a time before these reasons obtained, and that was the prebiotic soup, which we know very little about, except that the underlying mechanism was there. If we had some fossil soup, it would be very nice, because we'd be able to test against it. But I do agree with you. I think that the artifacts are not the replicators. I mean, even if you mold the glass and make lots more copies of it, it's still not the replicator. You need all the technology for it. It is a sort of extended phenotype, or it's a kind of, it's almost a nail clipping off the phenotype. It doesn't exist on its own. It's an indicator of something larger. And I don't know whether that existed in the prebiotic soup or not. Am I allowed to mention Steve Jones said the big question about prebiotic soup is, did it have to be minestrone? And his argument is that minestrone is lumpy, and you've got patterns, and the patterns recur, and you look around for, you know, the kids' letters in it and that sort of thing, and that the certain things do recur. And I imagine there would have been extended phenotypes swimming around there.
The slogan today is a prebiotic pizza. It was on the surface. None of this sloshing about in solution.
Well, when I was working up some of this material, I tried to see whether I could fit the notions of replicators and interactors, of phenotypes and genotypes, precisely to the technological situation. And I found a certain number of difficulties with actually linking, putting them into those categories. It isn't really quite as simple. It's one of the difficulties about the biological analogy, which I didn't go into, and that is that you don't really have quite the same type of relationships between them. And in fact, there is somebody said, what about evolution of language? I mean, one of the sorts of, in our discussions on this, and my first shot at that is that in language, the words, the entities, etc., are both replicators and interactors. That they don't actually have, they don't separate there. They are the same thing in a strange way. And this is a different sort of selective system for that sort of reason.
Yeah. But, I mean, the question of that, it's quite right that, I mean, the notion that most of us would today support would be that before there was a distinction between genotype and phenotype, there were replicating molecules which were both the thing that replicated and the thing that did something. One more question, I think, and comment. Yes.
Martin Knight, I'm a retired businessman. I'd like to go back to the answer given to Gary Runciman's question, because I understood in this way of thinking, purpose thinkers have no place. And everything I've heard since confirms that impression. But if purposes have no place in this mode of thinking, it doesn't relate much to the kind of world I know. How do you answer that?
A good question.
If
you can answer it, you get a hamburger.
Oh, right. my good friend Peter Muntz has written a lovely book called Philosophical Darwinism. I strongly recommend it. It's a beautiful book, all sorts of interesting ideas about it, a rather philosophical kind. And his view is that the selection mechanisms are actually deleterious. Selection mechanisms for cultural objects, ideas and so on, they're actually deleterious and bad, that the purposes for which they're done are actually very often quite anti-progressive, anti-life and so on. He has a whole a theory of this, paradoxical as it may seem. The strange thing is that somehow or another we managed to stumble on. It seems to me that these are the sorts of questions one has to be very careful not to impose into this sort of discussion too strong notions about, you know, the purposiveness at each phrase, or too strong a notion of purposiveness is effectual. It is the unintended consequences are the interesting parts very often of this side of discourse. Do I have to have a beef hamburger now?
Yes,
you
have a brief
hamburger. Yeah. Half. Do you want the last word?
Thank you. I think it is a problem, and I think it's one of the problems underlying the acceptance of the Darwinian mechanism right across this field, that it is so counterintuitive, it is so against the way we look at things, it's so against all that stuff inside our heads. And after all, you wouldn't expect us to be able to cope with it normally, because we would be pretty lousy animals if we thought in terms of memes the whole time. We've got to operate empirically, we've got to operate in a real world, and it's only when you get a long way up the kind of out on the academic limb, do you actually have any time or place to think these silly thoughts? But I think that the meme or the Darwinian approach is an underlying mechanism. It's counterintuitive. People don't like it, and they're going to go on fighting it for a very long time.
Before I thank our speakers, I have an important announcement to make, which is that if you go where we had tea, there is a rumour that there will be drinks, and you are very welcome. I believe, John, why don't you say something right away?
Well, let me say it straight away. May I thank Helena Cronin and the Darwin... Do you call yourself the Darwin Centre now? Is that a new name for Centre for the Philosophy of the Natural and Social Sciences, which always takes up a whole line on the envelope and very difficult. Helena, I realise... quickly, when I saw what the Darwin seminars were about, and especially when I came to one, I realized this was a wonderful way of getting a venue and system for having this type of discussion. And I thank you, Helena, for doing this jointly with us and providing the framework of the discussion. Thank you very much.
And it just remains to me to thank our two speakers, and actually all four speakers today, and I'd also like to thank the audience. I think we've had a really, really good discussion for the last half hour. I've enjoyed it anyway. So thank you all very much.